Jepsen was an odd figure, Wilson reflected, raddled and raffish, but oddly romantic. Looked 10 years older than his 30 years. Reddish, blonde hair combed back, heavy moustache, very slender body bent forward, grey-blue eyes and very pronounced cheekbones, unhealthy pale complexion. Lung disease? Smokes about 100 cigarettes over a day. Very bad teeth from frequent smoking. Eats little and drinks only champagne. Unable to drive. Rides horseback. Writes philosophical books. Yet, as Jepsen's trail of seduction showed, there was something intensely attractive about him, and a core of strength that belied his twitchy manner. Wilson trusted him. No doubt artist is acting mainly out of self-interest, but of a clear-sighted and long-term character. A man of his undoubted intelligence is unlikely to try to deceive us on any matter where he is liable to be found out after the war. Wilson was quite sure that Jepsen was prepared to risk his life for the Allied cause. I am convinced that artist sincerely desires to continue to work wholeheartedly with us. When they parted, Wilson told him, I hope our collaboration will endure a very long time. Wilson's report caused both delight and consternation in London. This was intelligence of the highest quality, with the promise of more to come. On the other hand, as Astor and Harris had feared, Jepsen was in a position to expose the falsity of the German networks in Britain, now supplying actively deceptive material in the run-up to D-Day. The extent of artists' possible knowledge of Garbo is a matter of some concern, wrote Tarr, who wondered whether Jepsen knew or merely suspected that the German agents in Britain were frauds. Obviously, if artists were approached directly on this matter, it would immediately arouse his suspicion. Wilson assured him, I do not think he has any positive proof. But then, Jepsen did not need any. The continued flow of information from the D-Day spies would be proof enough of the massive hoax being perpetrated on the German high command. Artist's zeal and ability, Churchill was told, has verged upon the embarrassing. He has begun to provide us with information about the networks maintained by the Germans in this country. Of these, the principal one is the Garbo organization, of which it is clearly undesirable that he should make us too fully aware. We are engaged at the moment in the delicate operation of diverting this valuable agent's attention elsewhere. There is good promise of success. While Jepsen was getting to know his new British spymasters, Dushko Popov settled back in with his German handlers. Von Kaustoff was genuinely glad to see him. Popov was not only his most valuable intelligence asset, but also the guarantor of his profligate lifestyle. He examined Popov's haul of information with something less than a critical eye, and pronounced it excellent. Canaris had recently questioned whether Popov was worth his pay, but the latest batch of intelligence, von Kaustoff predicted, would convince the Abwehr chief that he was really valuable. He threw a dinner party in Popov's honor, and invited Jepsen, Alois Schreiber, the new head of counterintelligence, and their secretaries. It was a bizarre occasion. Two of the guests were German intelligence officers, and two others were secretly working for British intelligence. Jepsen was sleeping with Schreiber's secretary, who was spying on her boss. The married von Kaustoff was having an affair with his secretary, Elisabeth Scharbach, while ripping off the Abwehr. Popov was conducting at least 6 love affairs. Everyone was involved in the lying and cheating game, except Mabel Harbottle, Jepsen's secretary, who was not sleeping with or deceiving anyone and probably never had. Von Kaustoff proposed a congratulatory toast, declaring that, in return for his latest intelligence haul, Popov could expect a payment of $15,000. Alois Schreiber agreed that Popov's report was good and had been sent by courier to Berlin. His manner, however, was chilly. After the dinner party, von Kaustoff flew to Baden-Baden for an Abwehr conference and returned ecstatic. Popov was now considered the best man the Abwehr have. The accolade was duly passed back to Wilson in London, who observed, This may well have been deliberate flattery, but there seems to be no doubt he is at the moment extremely highly regarded. With greedy relish, von Kaustoff told Popov that if his work was really good, he could get almost anything he asked for. Plans were already being laid to send him back to Britain with more money, a fresh batch of secret ink, and a new questionnaire demanding a range of information on just about everything. As Popoff later put it, short of a detailed account of Churchill's digestive processes. Popoff was instructed to begin transmitting from outside London, as Hitler's flying bombs would soon be laying waste to the capital. For Popoff and Jebsen, these weeks in Lisbon offered the first opportunity since the war had begun to speak to each other without dissembling or inferring what could not be spoken. They were now officially on the same side in the game, though utterly different in temperament. As P.G. Wodehouse once remarked of cricket, some batsmen are nervous all through a long innings. With others, the feeling disappears with the first boundary. Popoff was unflappable, where Jebsen was a jangle of jagged nerves. But they made an outstanding partnership. They spent many happy, dissolute hours together, a pair of British spies pretending to be German spies, spending Hitler's money on themselves. Jebsen took a house in Estoril with four servants, while Popoff lived at the Palacio Hotel. They celebrated Christmas together, and Popoff sent a cheery seasonal message, in secret ink, to MI5. I shall spend my Christmas in Portugal buying national lottery tickets and letting people shine my shoes, he wrote, wishing you and all our friends a happy Christmas. But as he boarded the plane for London a week later, Popoff's spirit was troubled. He knew he was leaving his old friend in dire peril. If Jebsen had asked for asylum, he would have been safely alongside him on the plane to Britain. But he had not. The tricycle files contain a handwritten letter Popoff wrote to Jebsen soon after his return to London. It offers a glimpse into what he called the dilemma of spying, balancing duty against friendship, risking the life of someone he loved to protect thousands he would never know. Given the choice between helping a friend and ruining a much bigger cause, or making a friend take a chance and try to save the cause, he wrote, I would opt for the second solution. What is more, I am sure you would do the same. In his uncertain English, Popoff tried to tell Jebsen how much their friendship meant to him and to the cause they now shared. If this case would depend on anybody else but you, I would be desperate. 17. Monty's Double. On the day Popoff landed back in Britain, a brilliant British Army officer and part-time transvestite emerged from an army cinema south of Naples after a screening of the Billy Wilder film Five Graves to Cairo, with one of the last and oddest elements of the deception swirling around in his mind. Lieutenant Colonel Dudley Clark was the head of A Force, a highly successful deception unit based in Cairo, and one of the architects of Bodyguard. He was a film buff, with a flair for the dramatic. Indeed, Clark's taste for dressing up had landed him in hot water a year earlier, when he was arrested in Madrid wearing women's clothes. Five Graves to Cairo was set in the North African campaign and starred Erich von Stroheim as Rommel. But it was Miles Mander, the actor playing a remarkably plausible General Montgomery, that set Clark's peculiar mind whirring. Montgomery would be the Allied ground troops commander for the D-Day invasion. If an actor playing Montgomery were to be spotted somewhere else in the world immediately before the invasion, then the Germans might assume the cross-channel attack was not imminent. It could buy precious time and soften German defences at a vital moment. Clark's idea was adopted with enthusiasm by the deception planners at LCS, and Operation Copperhead was born. But casting the right actor for the part proved tricky. Mander was found to be several inches taller than the real general, a physical handicap it was impossible to disguise. A substitute was found, who then fell victim to a road accident and broke his leg. The search was about to be abandoned when a Soho theatrical agency came up with Myrick Clifton James, an Australian-born lieutenant in the Army Pay Corps and a former variety performer. James was not a good actor. He could neither sing nor dance, and he had lost a finger in the trenches. He had volunteered to entertain overseas troops, but instead wound up in Leicester, performing in the Pay Corps variety troupe. But he had one act that never failed to get the audiences cheering. With his thin face and grey, drooping moustache, he could do a splendid Monty impersonation. The actor David Niven, Then a colonel in the Army Film Unit contacted James and asked him to come to London, where he was assigned to Montgomery's staff, under cover as a journalist, to study the general's speech patterns and mannerisms. In February 1944, it was publicly announced that the victor of El Alamein had arrived in Britain to take command of Allied land forces. From then onwards, it was certain that German agents would do their best to watch his movements. But where should the fake Monty be exhibited for German viewing? Supposing he were to be seen somewhere in the Mediterranean a day or two before the Normandy invasion, the Germans would take it as a certain indication that they had at least a week or more to wait before the landings. Gibraltar was selected as the ideal stage for Monty's double. The airfield there was known to be kept under surveillance by the Germans. The Rock was also the stamping ground of a particularly efficient and unscrupulous spy, Major Ignacio Molina Perez, who had been in MI5 sights for some time. Molina was on the staff of the Algeciras military governor and liaison officer between the Spanish government and the British authorities in Gibraltar. Spanish officials were supposed to be neutral. In reality, MI5 knew that Molina was a fully paid-up German spy codenamed Cosmos, and bad from head to foot. Molina has been decorated by the German government on various occasions, and it has been proved, with a wealth of detail, that Molina is the prime mover in an extensive Nazi secret service organization in Spain and Morocco. Molina himself is not aware we are out for his blood, the defense security officer in Gibraltar reported. One of the most irritating aspects of the case is that although we know him to be a German agent, he continues to enjoy every facility to enter and leave the fortress. We have not been able to catch him in flagrante delicto. Something more must be done, since at any moment he may get hold of some really valuable information. Molina was the ideal target for the hoax. If he spotted Montgomery in Gibraltar, he would immediately alert the Germans, and the British would have copper-bottomed proof of Molina's espionage. Operation Copperhead might have the satisfactory side effect of stuffing Agent Cosmos. The ground was prepared by spreading rumors that Montgomery was coming to North Africa, via Gibraltar, in order to discuss plans for the invasion of southern France before the launch of the main invasion in the north. James began rehearsing his part, which meant changing his habits. James was a heavy drinker and smoker, whereas Monty was teetotal and loathed smoking. A prosthetic finger was constructed to replace the missing one. The fake Monty trimmed his mustache, dyed his sideburns, and was issued khaki handkerchiefs monogrammed BLM. Monty is rather flattered by the whole plan, which, of course, is based on the theory that the Second Front could not possibly start without him, Guy Liddell reported. This is just the sort of plan that might conceivably come off, like Operation Mincemeat. In obedience to bureaucratic niceties, James would be paid the equivalent of a general's pay for every day he impersonated Monty. While a boozy actor was rehearsing the part of a fake general, a real general was preparing to take over a fake army. With the bogus 1st United States Army Group, FUSAG, supposedly assembling in Kent, the deception team needed someone to take command. George Patton, the inspiring, swashbuckling, and supremely unpleasant general who had led US troops into Sicily, was under a cloud for abusing and slapping soldiers traumatized by battle, in the belief that they were malingering cowards. "I ought to shoot you myself," General Patton told one terrified man. "There's no such thing as shell shock. It's an invention of the Jews." Eisenhower forced him to apologize and, to Patton's fury, denied him overall command of ground forces for the coming invasion. Instead, Patton was ordered to serve under Montgomery as commander of the Third Army. The Germans rated Patton highly. "That's the best man they have," Hitler insisted. So, at the suggestion of Christopher Harmer, he was appointed commander of the Ghost Army. By a judicious combination of leaks, newspaper reports, and double agent messages, the belief that General Patton was in command of FUSAG took root in German thinking. Patton stomped around England acting the part. He called himself a goddamn natural-born ham, which he most certainly was, loudly hailing other officers with such remarks as, "See you in the Pas de Calais." The scandal over the slapping incident even reinforced the deception, since the Germans assumed this was an invented story to disguise Patton's command of the most important D-Day army. The general's outspoken tactlessness enraged Eisenhower. "I am thoroughly weary of your failure to control your tongue," he told him. But the intelligence services were delighted. Whenever Patton said something like, "It is the evident destiny of the British and Americans to rule the world," this made headlines, and the headlines made their way to Germany, keeping Nazi eyes firmly focused on Patton and his bogus army. The components of the plan were slotting into place. To keep enemy forces pinned down in Norway, Allied intelligence imagined into being the British Fourth Army, poised to attack from Scotland, supported by American Rangers deployed from Iceland. Fortitude North was backed up by wireless traffic mimicking a real army preparing for an amphibious landing and mountain warfare. In reality, wireless trucks driving around Scotland, sending volleys of Morse code into the ether, some 350 people representing a force of 100,000 men. The officer in command of this notional force was General Sir Andrew "Bulgy" Thorne, a whiskery First World War veteran who had met Hitler when he was military attaché at the British Embassy in Berlin in the 1930s. Thorne and Hitler had fought on opposite sides of the trenches at Ypres and discussed their shared experiences. Hitler, it was calculated, would be more likely to take seriously an army under the command of an old warhorse he knew personally. Thorne even inspected real American troops in Northern Ireland, as if he were their commanding officer, in the hope that German spies in Ireland would feed the information back to Germany. As the Northern deception gathered speed, the planners would add additional touches, declaring the Firth of Forth a protected area, as if a great and secret host were assembling there. Soviet forces would mass on the Norwegian border, suggesting a simultaneous assault from the east. At the same time, diplomatic approaches were made to neutral Sweden, requesting the use of its airfields and asking the Swedish Air Force commander to consider a peacekeeping role in Norway in the event of an Allied invasion. The pro-Nazi Swedish police chief was bugging the room in which this conversation took place, and the lie flew back to Berlin. The officer responsible for implementing Fortitude North described the strange mental attitude brought on by inventing, organizing, and then deploying a completely invisible army. "As time went on, we found it hard to separate the real from the imaginary. The feeling that the Fourth Army really existed, and the fact that it was holding German troops immobilized, made one almost believe in its reality." This was precisely the mesmeric effect the planners hoped to induce in Hitler. The Führer had always considered Norway his zone of destiny. The aim of Fortitude North was to keep his attention and hundreds of thousands of German troops fixed there. A similar and even more elaborate charade was underway along the Channel coast. German forces defending Normandy, the Seventh Army, were formidable enough, but if they were reinforced by General Hans von Salmuth's mighty 15th Army, currently defending the Pas-de-Calais, then Normandy would be all but impregnable. The Calais troops must be kept where they were, not only before, but for as long as possible after the first attack on Normandy. The real Allied army massing in southwest England to attack Normandy should be as invisible as possible, while the fake army, supposedly gathering in the southeast, should be as loud and noticeable as Patton himself. Like stage managers on a massive scale, the planners began assembling props, scenery, and backdrops all over the southeast coast to simulate the mighty Fusag, a force of 150,000 men forming up, training, and preparing for battle. Fake troop camps, bogus airfields, more than 250 dummy assault landing craft known as wet bobs, and dummy tank landing craft known as big bobs, a wet bob being public school parlance for a rower, while a cricketer was a dry bob. The big bobs, built from hollow steel tubes and canvas, were so light that in high wind they broke loose and flew through the air, like enormous misshapen kites. Stray cows tended to eat the fake aircraft made from wood and canvas. From April, Wireless operators drove around Kent, simulating the wireless traffic of an entire corps preparing for battle. Plans were drawn up to establish a 10-mile exclusion zone around the coast. Robertson could never be fully certain he had intercepted every spy. So, as a precaution, misleading signs were erected in Kent, pointing to fake embarkation points. In Dover, all was commotion, as engineers scurried to and fro, pretending to build tunnels and wireless stations. Imitation docks and an oil storage complex were constructed by set builders from Shepperton Studios, following plans drawn up by the architect Basil Spence. King George VI's tour of this impressive and entirely unusable installation was duly reported in the press for the Germans to read. German intelligence, watching and listening, could not fail to realize that the Schwerpunkt, the focal point of the cross-channel attack, must be the Pas de Calais. The only problem was that the Germans were not able to see clearly and were hardly listening at all. Indeed, it has since emerged that they barely bothered to pick up the vast scree of wireless traffic and were unable to locate where it was coming from when they did. Allied air supremacy meant that German reconnaissance was strictly limited. Huge effort went into physical deception, camouflage, and signals traffic, but the Germans were not really paying attention. And why would they? They had numerous spies on the ground providing copious evidence of exactly what was going on. Why go to the trouble of intercepting, deciphering, and translating an avalanche of 13,358 coded wireless messages when they had direct information from Garbo and Brutus? On January 21st, Tar Robertson had announced to the W Board, which provided operational intelligence for double-cross purposes, that the moment of truth had arrived. He was, he said, 98% certain that the Germans trusted the majority of their agents, although there must always remain the additional 2% of doubt. The odds were good enough for the board, which authorized the 20 committee to deploy the double-cross agents in the way that had always been envisaged, to blow the entire project in the most elaborate and dangerous deception yet. Only agents in whom the Germans had absolute faith, as reflected in most secret sources, would be selected. And since the postal service would be cut off in the run-up to invasion, active deception would be restricted to agents with wireless transmitters. Garbo, Brutus, and Tate, Wolf Schmidt, all had well-established radio contact. Treasure, it was hoped, would soon get a radio set from Kleeman. Bronx would continue her letters as long as possible and then send a last-minute message by telegram using the agreed plain language code. That left Popoff. Lingering uncertainty over Jebsen's safety and reliability provoked another heated debate, with some arguing that the tricycle channel should not be used and should possibly be dismantled altogether. It fell once more to Ian Wilson, Popoff's case officer, to mount the defense. It has been suggested that Tricycle and his group are barred from conveying deceptive material because of the risk that artist will, willingly or under duress, disclose the fact that this group is controlled. The risk is extremely slight. It seems unthinkable that artist would voluntarily blow this case in view of the care he has taken in the past to protect double agents and of the very considerable body of information he has given us, which has proved true whenever we have been able to check it. His motives for working for us are extremely complex, but he is absolutely sincere in his actions. He cannot blow Tricycle without imminent danger of death to himself, his family, and Tricycle's family. Artist will be protected by the Abwehr from any attack on him by the Gestapo. Whatever danger existed has now diminished. Even if the Gestapo could get hold of Artist's person and extort a confession that Artist's agents were double-crossing, then the Abwehr would have to believe the confession. All the Abwehr officers, from the highest to the lowest, have a vested interest in supporting the bona fides of Tricycle. I very much doubt any of them would have the moral courage to admit that for years they have been fooled. The 20 Committee agreed to lift the veto on using Tricycle for deception. No ban, Wilson scrawled triumphantly across his memo. Popoff was past fit to play in the final championship match. The double-cross team had presented their case with supreme confidence, but there was apprehension in St. James's Street. Knowledge of the double agent network, once confined to a small esoteric group of persons, was now widely distributed among civilians and military personnel, with an increased danger of leakage. Paul Fidrmuch, the rogue freelancer in Lisbon, was still spraying conjecture and fantasy at the Germans, but it was not impossible that Ostro might, by fluke, give the exact area of attack on the continent and thus destroy the deception plan. And the Abwehr, the familiar enemy, was falling apart. If the organization collapsed or was subsumed by Himmler's SD, the intelligence agency of the SS and Nazi Party, then the corrupt, lazy and gullible officers B1A had gotten to know so well might be replaced by men of a different, more effective stamp. Rats would begin to desert the leaking ship. Already a number of disaffected Abwehr officers were extending feelers, hinting at possible desertion. Here was the artist problem writ large. If an officer with knowledge of the German spy network in Britain defected, his colleagues would naturally assume he had betrayed those networks, and if the networks continued regardless, they would realize the spies were under Allied control. In short, the German turncoat, in trying to assist us, would in fact destroy our entire system. Even stone-souled John Masterman confessed to annoying anxiety as the pace of deception accelerated. "The whole existence of the double-cross system hung in the balance just before D-Day," he wrote. "Failure was dangerously close." When the final, definitive deception plan was approved by Churchill in late February 1944, with just over 3 months to go, Christopher Harmer, the link between the double agents and the military planners, turned to Roger Fleetwood Hesketh and uttered the thought that all wondered, but few dared voice, "I can't believe we will ever get away with it." 18. The Double Dash. The participants in the deception, great and small, set to work. Flight Lieutenant Walker gathered his flock of second-rate pigeons. An Australian actor worked on his Montgomery impersonation. General Patton stamped around England, drawing attention to himself. And the American double agents, led by Max Rudloff, the libertine Argentinian, fed shreds of falsehood indicating the attack would be delayed. But the central, swelling chorus of lies would come from the double-cross spies. Hitler's most trusted source of information on the military build-up in Britain and Churchill's trump cards. The deception was built from myriad tiny fragments of misinformation, a mosaic for the enemy to piece together. Directly pointing to the Pas-de-Calais as the target area would be far too obvious, and exceedingly dangerous if the plot was discovered. You cannot baldly announce to the enemy that such and such an operation is in preparation, insisted Masterman. You cannot just volunteer information. Instead, the great lie would be made up of snippets, gleanings and hints, buried in a mass of other information, some of it true. Roman Chernavsky began implementing the bogus threat to Norway. Chopin, his wireless operator, sent a message to Oscar Reiler reporting that the Polish spy was heading north for a Polish military conference. He had a good reason for visiting Scotland, inasmuch as the majority of Polish troops were stationed there, and he was recognized by the Germans as a highly trained military observer. Agent Brutus began relaying the faked Allied order of battle, just as he had once reported on the real strength of German troops in occupied France. He provided the Germans with the Fourth Army's insignia and headquarters location in Edinburgh, described large bodies of troops in Stirling and Dundee, and offered evidence that American and Norwegian forces were also gathering. Brutus followed up by describing the arrival of Soviet staff officers in Edinburgh to back up the notion of a pincer movement. The Norwegian agents Muttinge Jeff made similar observations, and Garbo's Scotland-based sub-agents pitched in with troop sightings in Dundee and major naval exercises on the Clyde. Freak, Popoff's radio operator, invented a talkative American naval officer who revealed he would shortly be joining General Thorne's staff. The Germans were pleased. Your latest vials are very satisfactory. Congratulations. Please state exact number of divisions, etc., belonging to 4th Army under General Thorne. Like a spoiled lover, Chernavsky badgered his German handlers for expressions of affection and support, demanding money to increase the efficiency of his espionage activities and new equipment. Urgently require 2 new wireless sets and 2 new codes. As a result of my visit to Scotland, I have report of many pages to send you urgently, and without the necessary assistance from you, it will be impossible to transmit the information which I am collecting at sufficient speed. The Germans responded soothingly. Many thanks for your hard and valuable work. What place can we best send you the money and the piano? Can you suggest a place which would be suitable for a plane to come low enough to drop what you want? Chernavsky advised the Germans to parachute a package to him at a remote spot near Beccles, in Suffolk. When there was no response, he sent a peevish message demanding to know whether the lack of reply was due to a lack of confidence in him. Reiler was unctuous. I have complete confidence in you, but there are still difficulties. The Germans' plans for re-equipping him came to nothing, but their willingness to try confirmed the esteem in which Chernavsky was held. He is a man who succeeds in creating the impression of Herculean ability, and from their knowledge of him, the Germans will expect him to achieve the impossible or bust. Brutus is a professional spy and an artist at producing the most detailed and illustrated reports. The D-Day spies all swung into action for Fortitude South. By mid-February, Garbo's doughty team of fictional Welsh fascists were deployed all along the south coast, and Puyol was commended by Karl Erich Kuhlenthal for the amplification of your network. The Welsh spies in particular were giving the best results. The Gibraltarian waiter was also well placed after supposedly getting a job in a canteen at a Hampshire military base. The sub-agents sent information to Puyol, which he gathered, graded, put into his own inimitably dense prose, and then sent on by radio to Madrid, where Kuhlenthal consumed it with insatiable appetite. Garbo sent himself on a notional tour of the south coast. He reported seeing American soldiers, but predicted the invasion would not happen for a long time, and certainly not until an assault force immeasurably greater in number than that which exists has been assembled. The Germans could relax. I am surprised to hear of the nervousness which exists in official circles with regard to the Allied offensive. I recommend once again calm and confidence in our work. That work was already monumental and would grow steadily in the following weeks. Between the beginning of January and D-Day, 500 wireless messages passed between Garbo and his controllers. Harris worried that no single person could, in reality, have marshaled such an enormous quantity of information. This thought never struck the Germans. Dushko Popov gathered intelligence of a quality, complexity, and duplicity greater than anything he had supplied before. He made his own tour of the Kent coast and reported that preparations for a great armada were plainly underway, but incomplete. An extensive program for preparing and improving cookhouses, washhouses, tented camps, and landing grounds has been drawn up, but nearly all of it still has to be done. In spite of intensive preparations, there are no signs that invasion is imminent. Dover Harbour was being overhauled to accommodate a huge task force, he reported, but again, a lot of work still had to be done. From Dover he travelled on to Portsmouth, Southampton, and Exeter, describing intense military commotion in the east and inactivity in the west. Tarr debated whether to send Tricycle into the enemy camp once again. Alone among the double agents, he could place the deception, physically, in enemy hands. His stock is very high in German eyes, and it is desired to take advantage of this fact and of the opportunity of his being able to take documents to the Germans. Popov would go back to Lisbon one last time, carrying a mass of detailed information to support the deception. Eyewitness reports from the Channel ports, doctored documents, and conversations with Norwegian government officials in London, who said they expected to be home before summer. Johnny Jebsen reported that von Kersthoff was swallowing Popov's reports unchewed and proclaiming that the landing in Western Europe will not take place until next spring. Berlin's response was equally positive. Colonel Georg Hansen declared Popov the Abwehr's top spy, and his radio connection the best in the whole Abwehr. Jebsen shone a light directly into the minds of his colleagues. "Their chief hope is to receive reports about the date of the landing in France," he told MI6. "It is quite possible to deceive with regard to the date, as Tricycle's reliability is no longer in doubt. But all reports must contain a saving clause so that when an event which has been announced does not occur, the blame can be attributed to wrong information received. Reports submitted with a reservation are more easily believed than categorical statements. These reports should be sent containing a wealth of small detail." Jebsen was now actively coaching the Allied team. While Brutus focused on the north, and Garbo and Tricycle worked on the southern deception, Bronx looked west. Most secret sources showed that Elvira's reports were now graded very important and distributed to both the operational sections of the Abwehr and Army Intelligence HQ in Berlin. She still addressed her letters, in secret ink, to Bleyl, unaware that the man who had recruited her in France was no longer handling her case. Her new controller was one Hauptmann Dr. Bernd Schlüter, a former officer in the Paris Abwehr, now operating out of Cologne, and an altogether more formidable figure than the feckless, drunken Bleyl. Incoming letters to Bronx took on a more urgent tone. Important. Invasion details. Eisenhower's and Montgomery's HQ? Parts of coast evacuated? Concentration of ships and barges? Admiralty circles talk of invasion? Arrivals of American troops? Expenses and bonus for invasion news. Bronx bolstered both fortitudes south and north, but her singular hold on the Germans, it was decided, should be employed elsewhere in the deception. The Germans had substantial forces deployed in the Bordeaux area of southwest France, most notably the feared 17th SS Panzer Grenadier Division. Once the invasion was underway, its tanks would certainly be deployed north to try to repel the Allies. Every hour the panzers could be detained in the southwest would help. Just as the 15th Army might be tied down in Calais by Operation Fortitude, so a new and equally fictitious threat would be aimed at the Bordeaux area. This was Operation Ironside. The imaginary assault would begin with an attack in the Bay of Biscay from the west coast ports of the UK, opening the way for an American force sailing directly from the United States. Several double agents would contribute. Rudloff in the United States reported that a force trained in fording rivers was assembling to tackle the watery terrain of southwest France. Tate said his girlfriend Mary, who worked in the Admiralty, had returned from Washington after working on a plan for a U.S. expeditionary force. Bronx had already agreed to send a coded telegram to warn of an invasion. "She is independent and aloof from all our other agents, so that reasonable risks can be taken in running her without compromising any other agent." Elvira would implement Operation Ironside almost single-handedly. No small feat for an agent once dismissed as a good-time girl with no allegiance to anyone except herself. Timing was critical. In order to achieve our object of containing the German Panzer Division in the region of Bordeaux, it will be necessary to time the telegram to arrive on D-2, 2 days before D-Day. Telegrams to Lisbon took 5 days. To reach the Germans in time, the message would have to be sent on or before May 29th. The telegram, indicating to the Germans that an attack will definitely be made against the Bay of Biscay, would be followed by a letter in secret ink, once the invasion was underway and the postal service was restored, providing a get-out for Bronx by explaining how she had made a mistake. The only objection, as usual, came from MI6, sniping from the sidelines. Claude Danzy told Elvira it was ludicrous to expect the Germans to swallow such an implausible ruse. Astor reported, I told her I consider his opinion to be completely fallacious, and that we were best qualified to decide on running her case. The secret services tended to get far angrier with each other than they ever did with the enemy. Mary Shearer spent 3 weeks coaching Lily Sergeyev on her cover story. In the evenings she took her to the theatre or a movie. Sometimes Louisa, Gisela Ashley, comes as well. Lily wrote, "I'm very fond of Louisa, but somehow I just can't bring myself to trust her, or Mary, or Robertson. I suppose if I lived a long time in England, I would become like the English, cold, reserved, impersonal." Even when Mary laughed in the cinema, it struck Lily as forced, a polite little laugh, prim and restrained, sort of a miser's laugh. Since the death of her dog, she had begun to refer to the B1A team as Robertson and his gang. When Tar came to say farewell, Lily asked him, "If Kleeman questions me about the invasion, do I say yes or no?" "What do you think yourself?" he replied cryptically. "I think it'll be soon." "Then tell him so." There was a pause. "You know how much we are counting on you." Agent Treasure shook Tar's hand without enthusiasm. "His words don't make much impression on me." She had bought a gift for Kleeman at Dunhill's on Piccadilly, a pigskin wallet engraved with the words, "For Octave, a souvenir from London, 29th February 1944, Solange." She told Mary, "I am absolutely sure of being able to cope with him." In truth, she was looking forward to seeing Kleeman again. Treasure landed in Lisbon on March 1, 1944. She had sent a letter ahead telling Kleeman when she would be arriving. Inevitably, he wasn't there. She checked into the Palacio Hotel, telephoned the German legation, and left a message for Kleeman. A few hours later, a slim, fair youngster with slicked back hair and an ingratiating smile knocked on her hotel room door and introduced himself as Hopper. Kleeman, he said, would be arriving soon. Treasure waited. After the damp gloom of London, Lisbon in early spring was enchanting. She wandered the bazaars and fruit stalls, admiring the black and white marble pavements and the trees in bloom. These were Judas trees. The irony of the name was not lost on her. She made contact with MI6 and was told to be patient. Privately, the British wondered if Kleeman was a busted flush. A message had recently appeared in most secret sources, indicating that Berlin were very pleased with the work she was doing, but were not pleased with Kleeman, who was considered slack and inefficient, and might get the sack. After 12 days of waiting, Treasure's patience was exhausted. She summoned Hopper to her hotel and blew a gasket. "Kleeman is a saboteur," she shrieked. "He has no order, no method. He ought to be shot. You are all hopelessly incompetent. I am fed up with it." Still, it took 3 more days before Hopper reappeared, very excited, to tell her, "Our friend is here." On the morning of March 14th, Hopper drove her to the Place Pombal, at the top of Avenida da Liberdade. A familiar, square-shouldered figure appeared, melodramatically, from behind the fountains. Kleeman embraced her warmly. He was smartly dressed, as always, in a blue suit and felt hat, but thinner, his hair greyer than before. She noted, for the first time, that his upper teeth were false. "He looks much older," she wrote. "Something akin to pity stirs in me." He was delighted to see her, and as self-centered as ever. "My stock has gone up recently because of your success," he declared. "You are the first person to have achieved this, to have got yourself into England, to have come out again, and to be able to return. I am very proud of you, Lily. Your success has helped my position a good deal. I nearly lost my job. If you give up now, it'll be the end of me." In the back of Hopper's car, Kleeman talked non-stop, mostly about himself. His leg had recently been poisoned, which is why he had lost weight, he said. He had spent Christmas with Yvonne at Thonon-les-Bains, on the Swiss-French frontier. He wanted Yvonne to fire her maid, who was lazy and impertinent and always answering him back. Like all truly selfish people, Kleeman believed the minutiae of his life must be fascinating to all. The car stopped outside an apartment block, and Kleeman led her upstairs to an empty flat. On the table lay a parcel wrapped in paper and string. He was beaming with pride. She unwrapped it to find what looked like an ordinary transistor radio in a shabby wooden case. Inside was a transmitter, almost certainly a wireless taken from a captured British SOE agent. Here are the two holes to which you connect your tepper. It's the only outward sign that could arouse suspicions, said Kliman. A wireless expert would show Lily how to make a Morse code tapper from household items. But first, Kliman declared brightly, some sightseeing, and then lunch. A few hours later, Lily stood on the ramparts of the Castello dos Muros, the great Moorish fort looking out over Sintra. On the 15-mile drive from Lisbon, Kliman had happily prattled away about how satisfied the bosses were with Lily and, more important, with him. Berlin was very pleased with her for getting to Bristol. Her descriptions of divisional signs were very well given and very precise. She was to send more like that. In the future, she must also send bomb damage reports. It is a very worrying business, running agents, he remarked, because with most of them, I am always worrying about whether they are double-crossing or not. With you, in whom I have complete confidence, it makes me feel bad to be sending you to do such unpleasant things and to run such risks. Still, he reflected, the war might soon be over. The situation is quite hopeless, and it is only a matter of time before Germany will have to give in. He did not seem unduly concerned. They drove through delightful scenery, with blossoming fruit trees along the roadsides. Lily later remembered thinking that she didn't feel like going back to England. Lily had brought with her a small Zeiss camera. As they toured the castle, she said, "What about a picture? It would be a souvenir." "What a good idea. You did well to bring your camera," said Kliman, never suspecting that the camera had been supplied by MI5 for the express purpose of obtaining his picture for its files. Lily snapped Kliman as he clambered up through one of the castle turrets. Then she set the automatic shutter and took another photograph of the two of them, together, beside a fountain. She is smiling a little coquettishly. He strikes his best spymaster pose. They are both visibly happy. Kliman ordered lunch at a small restaurant. While they were waiting for the food to arrive, she presented him with the wallet. His face lit up. Then he reached in his pocket and handed Lily a packet. Inside was a pretty bracelet of 45 diamonds set in platinum, £300 in notes, and 20,000 escudos. He was gathering more money, he said, which he would give her at midday tomorrow. After the meal was cleared away, Kliman grew serious. "Do you think there is going to be an Allied invasion?" Lily recalled what Tarr had said. "Yes, I too. When do you think it will take place?" "I think the landing is imminent." Kliman frowned and then launched into a prepared speech. "Now listen to me carefully, Lily. The next big move in the war will be the Allied landing. Our only chance of winning at the moment is to throw them back into the sea. To do that, we must know in advance where they are planning to land, so that we can prepare a hot reception. It could be in Holland or Belgium, but we don't think so. We are fairly sure that it will be in France, and there are two possibilities, either the Pas-de-Calais or Normandy. If they choose the Pas-de-Calais, the Allied troops will be concentrated on the Channel coast, but if it is to be Normandy, they will move them into the area around Bristol. Do you understand? What you must tell us is whether there is a build-up of troops and other activities, so we can work out where the enemy is making for. She should spend as much time as possible visiting her relatives in the West Country, paying particular attention to any military activity on Salisbury Plain, and reporting everything seen in or around Bristol. Where was Eisenhower's headquarters? What exercises were taking place? Were invasion barges arriving in Bristol from America? And if so, in what numbers? Information obtained by observation is of interest, but high-level gossip is not of much interest, as it rarely proves accurate. When her radio was working, she should transmit on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 11 p.m. "I want the transmissions to be as short as possible. The shorter, the better." Kliman reached into his wallet and presented Lily with a single British stamp. explaining that on the top left-hand corner was a microdot. "These are the instructions for the transmitting set in case you forget anything." She put the stamp in her note case. Only now did Kliman ask how she had managed to travel to Lisbon. Lily launched into her cover story about her job at the Ministry of Information and the propaganda films for which she was gathering material. Kliman nodded approvingly. She had memorized numerous corroborative details, including how Alfred Hitchcock was working for the Ministry's film division and exactly where the canteen was located. But he asked not a single question. After lunch, they strolled along the waterfront and watched the fishing boats pull away from the coast. Kliman turned to her. "What is our hold over you? My parents are still in Paris, as you once reminded me. But it would be better for you to realize that I am acting freely, rather than under pressure. You'd feel much surer of me." The answer seemed to satisfy this most incurious of spies. It was dark when they climbed into Hopper's car for the drive back to Lisbon. As they passed through Estoril, Kliman remarked, "I would like to have shown you the casino and take you to a chic restaurant for dinner, but it wouldn't be wise. The place is full of international gangsters, double agents, and intelligence agents. It is better that we shouldn't be seen together in public." The next morning, Hopper showed her how to make a Morse code tapper using a block of wood, a nail, a kitchen knife, and a book. He then handed over two new transmitting crystals and a list of frequencies and taught her a new code. Kliman arrived, carrying a large paper bag. Inside were 1,501-pound notes. He explained that he had planned to hide the money in a cigar box, but could not find one large enough. He would try to find banknotes of a larger denomination, he said, and a bigger box. Lily now explained that, as part of her propaganda work, she had made contact with the press attaché at the British Embassy, and he had agreed to send the radio to London in the diplomatic bag. This was a most implausible story. The diplomatic bag was used to transfer sensitive information. It was not a free luggage transportation service for civilians. But once again, Kliman evinced no suspicion and happily agreed that this was a wise move to avoid any possible curiosity by security officials at the airport. There was one more important piece of business. Now that she had a wireless, Lily would need a control signal, a way to indicate that she was now transmitting under British control, should she be caught. "We must take all possible precautions," said Kliman. "Suppose the British unmask you. They won't arrest you. They'll watch you for a short time. They'll register all your transmissions to make sure they know your methods. Then they'll force you to work for them under the threat of a revolver. I want to give you some means of warning us, some sign which they cannot detect, but for which we'll be watching very carefully." Kliman's plan was simple. If she was discovered by the British and told to go on transmitting, she was to call PSEQSLSK, Morse shorthand for Please Acknowledge Reception. Lily replied that this was silly, which it was, since if she added something new to a message, the British would know that this was some sort of sign. She suggested a more subtle danger code. "At the beginning of the message, between KA and the call sign, there is a dash. Sometimes I do it, sometimes not. If I do it twice, once in the message and once in the repetition of the message, it'll mean I'm no longer a free agent. But only if the dash is there both times. If it's only in once, it doesn't mean anything, because now and then I may send it just to make it less noticeable. If they comb through a series of my messages, they will see that it varies and won't pay any attention when I repeat it." Kliman was impressed. "That's excellent." In his notebook he wrote, "Strich zwischen Anfang und Nummer, dash between the beginning and number." They arranged to meet the next day at 11 a.m. in the Praça do Comércio, a few hours before Lily's flight. Kliman, astonishingly, was waiting, with a very large box of cigars under one arm. Inside, he whispered, under a layer of cigars and a false bottom, was £500 in £5 notes. They walked around the square, arm in arm. Timon paused by a fountain, lit a cigarette, and looked solemn. Even if it meant the end of my career, if you said you did not want to go back to England, I would not force you. I would rather go on until the end, said Lily. Timon was a ridiculous spy, a vain and fragile egotist, but he was also capable of gentleness, and he was offering his spy a way out. Lily's British spymasters had never shown her such care. Timon kissed her hand and walked away. In her diary, Lily wrote, 5 months ago, I was so full of enthusiasm, so ready to love the British, so eager to help them. I admired them. I trusted them. I had faith in British fair play. I worked readily for them. I took risks on their behalf. In return, I only asked for one thing, to keep my dog. It wasn't asking much, but it was too much for them. Tomorrow, I'll be in London. I'll hand them over the money, the code, the radio, everything, except for a dash. A dash that will enable me to destroy all my work, all their work, the minute I want to. I shall not use my power, I know that, but I will know that I have them at my mercy. Agent Treasure landed at Bristol Airport at 5:30 the next morning, in thick fog, and was driven to a hotel. There she was given a cup of tea and some toast, along with a tiny square of margarine and half teaspoonful of marmalade. A few minutes later, Mary Shearer strode in, bustling and businesslike. Lily handed over the box of cigars with the cash inside, the radio crystals, the stamp with the microdot, the diamond bracelet, and the photographs of Kleeman smiling in the sun. "He must be daft," said Mary. "The Colonel will be absolutely delighted." Robertson came to Rugby Mansions the next day to congratulate Lily in person. "So here you are again," he said jovially. "We didn't really expect you," and added, "They are very fine cigars." The radio, money, and bracelet were examined by MI5's experts. The transmitter was pronounced to be indistinguishable from an ordinary radio to the untrained eye. Exactly 39 of the 5-pound notes were forgeries. The bracelet was valued at £175. Lily described her conversation with Kleeman, his hunger for information about military manoeuvres in the southwest, and his almost endearing naivety. "I have nothing against Kleeman personally," she told Mary. "He has always treated me very well, and it makes me feel very badly to have to lie to him and cheat him." "What would he do if he thought you were controlled?" Mary asked. "Presumably he would not tell Berlin, because this would make him look such a fool. I am absolutely sure that if he thought I was double-crossing, he would report it." Mary sent a glowing report to Tar. Treasure gave a very good account of herself, particularly given the flimsy nature of her story. "She did very well in Lisbon and has provided us with a new, very valuable channel of communication." Yet there was one aspect of Lily's story that troubled her. Mary had studied the files in B1A. So far, every wireless agent sent by the Germans had a control signal, a way to tip off the Abwehr that they had been caught and were sending messages under British direction. Sometimes this was merely a misspelling or an added comma. Kleeman had briefed her intensively on how to operate her wireless, but no suggestion for indications of operation under duress was made. Lily never mentioned a control signal. She states she was never given any security check or other means of informing the Germans if she was controlled by the British. In fact, they never spoke of the possibility of this happening. Having made a note of this anomaly, Mary Shearer promptly forgot about it. On April 13th, Mary took Lily to Hampstead Heath, to a house with a royal blue front door. The little radio transmitter had been set up in a top-floor bedroom. At 12 minutes past midnight, Lily sent a message to Kleeman, "Arrived safely." She did not insert a dash, either in the message or in its repetition. Over the next 2 months, whenever she tapped out a message, she thought about the dash. "Every time, I know that I can destroy the work of 3 years. Just a dash, and the Germans will know that I work under the control of the intelligence service, and the British will suspect nothing. This is my revenge. They made me a promise, and they didn't keep it. Now I shall have them in my power." 19. Jebsen's New Friend. Johnny Jebsen was a one-man production line of secrets. His reports, funneled back to Britain via MI6 in Lisbon, contained an extraordinary wealth of detail about flying bombs, economic conditions in Germany, intelligence reports, and even an account of opinions expressed by Hitler and Himmler and Kaltenbrunner, the chief of the Reich Main Security Office, RSHA. Artist's information was gleaned from no less than 39 subsources and informants, ranging from Abwehr secretaries to Canaris himself, and the quality was so good that MI6, territorial as ever, wondered whether it should be shared with other branches of intelligence, since there was no authority from C to act as a circulating section. Jebsen grew bolder. The V-2 rocket, the world's first long-range ballistic missile, was being manufactured at the Rax-Verica factory in Wiener Neustadt, using slave labor from Mauthausen concentration camp. Passing on this information, he seriously and earnestly put the proposition that when his trouble with the Gestapo is cleared up, he should return to Germany and organize the sabotage of the factory at Wiener Neustadt. Jebsen was now offering to sabotage the most potent secret weapon in the German arsenal. This proposal sounds fantastic, but I repeat that Artist takes it very seriously. Even more extraordinary was Jebsen's suggestion that MI6 should recruit as a spy the wife of one of Britain's most famous novelists. P.G. Wodehouse was now living with his wife, Ethel, in Paris, where the couple had regular contact with a number of high-ranking Germans. Jebsen saw an opportunity. Charles Desalis of MI6 reported, P.G. Wodehouse and his wife were great friends of Artist, who helped them financially from time to time. They are at the moment in Paris. Mrs. Wodehouse is very pro-British and is inclined to be rude to anyone who dares address her in German. She has on occasion said loudly in public places, "If you cannot address me in English, don't speak at all. You had better learn it, as you will have to speak it after the war anyway." Artist thinks she might be a useful source, as both she and her husband are in close touch with Paul Otto Schmidt, Hitler's interpreter, who often talks to her of the conversations he has had to interpret between Hitler and the various foreigners who visit him. Wodehouse himself is entirely childlike and pacifist. It is not known whether MI6 acted on this suggestion and recruited Ethel Wodehouse, but Jebsen's suggestion casts a new light on their time in Paris. Critics accused the novelist and his wife of living in queasy accommodation with the Nazis, after Wodehouse foolishly agreed to make radio broadcasts at the Germans' behest. Jebsen's report proves that while Wodehouse himself may have been passively apolitical, his wife was so anti-Nazi that she was considered a potential spy. Jebsen believed he was safe. Elements within the Abwehr saw him as anti-Nazi and latterly defeatist, but he had his defenders. A colleague in Berlin promised to warn him of any imminent danger. If he received a telegram saying "come back immediately," this was a prearranged signal which in fact meant "do not come, the Gestapo are after you." He had also recruited a new bedroom mole within the Lisbon Abwehr station, Baroness Marie von Gronau, the 23-year-old daughter of a pioneer aviator who was the Luftwaffe attaché in Tokyo. Marie was a secretary in the counterintelligence section and happily told Jebsen whatever was passing across her boss's desk. In jest, he asked Marie to marry him. She turned him down, but was fascinated by his intelligence and wide knowledge. She may have been equally attracted to the seemingly inexhaustible funds at his disposal. After the war, Marie von Gronau was asked if she had known Jebsen was a British agent. She replied that he had denied it so often, she assumed he must be, and recalled how he dropped telltale remarks, such as, "I am His Majesty's most loyal enemy," and "friendship goes across borders of nations, regardless of a state of war." Marie von Gronau was generous with her favors. When Jebsen arrived in Lisbon, she was already the mistress of the Italian air attaché and being courted by an SD officer named Volbrecht. One evening, Volbrecht told Marie that Jebsen was a macaco, a Portuguese term of abuse meaning monkey, and the Baroness passed the insult on to Jebsen. Although he had not the slightest idea what a macaco was, he did not like the sound of the word, and challenged Vollbrecht to a duel with pistols. Vollbrecht refused, saying his department did not allow duels. At some point in this period, Jebsen's wife, Laura, came to Lisbon to see her husband, a visit that seems to have done nothing to slow down his extramarital liaisons. Jebsen was spiralling into a most volatile frame of mind. Lily Grass, he declared, was still infatuated with him and passing on useful tidbits from the correspondence of her boss, Alois Schreiber, the head of counterintelligence. Schreiber has written to Berlin that, in his opinion, Tricycle is absolutely reliable and should be given the biggest and most secret tasks for big money, she told him. This was reassuring, yet Jebsen's nervousness and excitability was a headache. In late January, Charles de Salis telephoned Jebsen's villa in Estoril to find out that he had vanished. A discreet but intensive manhunt was launched. After 3 days, British intelligence was starting to panic when Jebsen reappeared, none the worse for his disappearing act, save for a hangover. He had been on an almighty binge with his new best friend, Hans Brandis. Hans Joachim Brandis was one of the numerous shady characters loosely attached to the Lisbon Abwehr station. He was 24 years old, fair-haired, half-Jewish, Swiss-educated, and so overweight that he had been declared unfit for military service. His father had owned a large machine tool factory in Berlin, and on the outbreak of war, Brandes and his brother, principally through bribery, had successfully registered themselves as non-Jewish. Brandes spent money liberally wherever he went, and was known to give as much as 30,000 marks to reserve officers whose salary is only some 700 marks monthly, merely to make things easier for himself. A shareholder in a Berlin armaments firm, he won a contract to supply arms to the Portuguese government. Arriving in Lisbon in 1943, Brandes set himself up as a trader in platinum, diamonds and shoe leather, and an occasional spy. He is personally befriended by Canaris, who has sent him here to be out of harm's way as he is partly Jewish, reported Jebsen. He is supposed to report through von Kastorf, but he does practically nothing, and seemed to have some sort of hold over the Abwehr station chief, almost certainly financial. His bribes go a long way, and he is certainly a specialist in that art. Brandes claimed to be running his own espionage network, including an IRA spy in Ireland, agents in Switzerland, and a Frenchman in North Africa named Barinki Darnoux. Brandes liked to boast, "With a great deal of cunning and craftiness, I have succeeded to settle down here in Lisbon for the duration of the war." He shared Jebsen's tastes and, it seemed, his politics. He made no secret of the fact that he is not only very anti-Nazi, but very pro-British, and hoped England would win the war. Together they roistered around Lisbon with secretaries in tow. Relations between artist and Brandes seem to have grown very close, MI6 reported. Early in January, Brandes told his new friend that he was going to Berlin and would try to persuade Canaris to cancel his order against artist's return to Germany. Jebsen did not tell Brandes about his work for the British, but he believed his new chum could easily be recruited as another double agent. In fact, MI6 had been tracking the mysterious Brandes ever since his arrival in Lisbon and had come to the conclusion that, like Ostro, he was a hoaxer. Kim Philby, the head of the MI6 Counterintelligence Iberian Desk, followed the progress of Brandes through most secret sources and concluded, "The organization he claims to run is fictitious." Brandes was perpetrating a deliberate fraud on the Abwehr, which made him susceptible to blackmail. "He is only 24 and half-Jewish," wrote Philby. "It is certain, therefore, that if he fails to maintain his position, he would find himself fairly rapidly on the Eastern Front. He is strongly anti-Nazi and has never made any serious attempt to provide the Abwehr with genuine information. He would have a positive motive for accepting our proposition." Brandes knew Jebsen had secret agents in Britain, but he assumed that Jebsen's reports to Berlin, like his own, were what he called constructive fantasy. He even offered to back up anything Jebsen might be sending to Berlin with his own inventions. Jebsen told de Salis he had enough confidence in Brandes to reveal to him that he was working for the British, but had not done so, and would not do so without agreement. Brandes was a slippery opportunist, said Jebsen, but he could be a useful ally. If he knew the truth, he would probably want to join the game. MI6 decided to keep a close eye on Jebsen's new friend. If and when the time seemed ripe, he could be brought into the game. I think Brandes might develop into a useful straight agent if he has any guts and strong anti-Nazi convictions, wrote Frank Foley of MI6. Jebsen was certain Brandes would persuade Admiral Canaris to lift the veto for my return, which was made for my safety, as the Gestapo does not want anything from me any longer. I myself will be able to leave shortly. But before Canaris could do any such thing, he was toppled. Early in February, an Abwehr officer named Erich Vermeeren slipped out of the Abwehr station in Istanbul and defected. He and his wife were smuggled to Britain via Cairo and Gibraltar and took up residence in a South Kensington flat belonging to Kim Philby's mother. Vermeeren's defection was the excuse the enemies of Canaris were waiting for. Hitler was enraged. Canaris had long been suspected of being disloyal, which he was, and of working to undermine Hitler, which he probably was too. He was dismissed, given a meaningless job, and finally placed under house arrest. The Abwehr would soon be taken over by the SD and subsumed into the Reich Main Security Office under the control of Himmler and Kaltenbrunner, and then abolished entirely. Jebsen had been predicting the downfall of Canaris for some time. His ousting brought with it an orgy of chaotic score-settling and internecine feuding. Some Abwehr officers demanded to be sent to the front. Others were dismissed. Those remaining in place did so in an atmosphere of crippling paranoia and uncertainty. Further dismissals will probably take place, Jebsen reported, to get over to weeding out of unsatisfactory double agents. The British, and many Germans, would continue to refer to the Abwehr, although the old organization was effectively obsolete. The chaos within German intelligence and the SD's power grab at the expense of the Abwehr sent a shudder of anxiety through the double-cross team. The Abwehr officers were the devils they knew. There was now a danger, as Masterman observed, that new brooms would sweep away much which we had tried to preserve. Jebsen had been at university in Freiburg with Erich Vermeeren and had helped him get a job in the Abwehr. The Vermeeren family, from Lübeck, was ardently anti-Nazi. Erich's mother, Petra Vermeeren, a distinguished German journalist, had come to Portugal early in the war in order to get out from under the Nazi regime. Jebsen knew her well, and on hearing of Vermeeren's defection, he rushed to her home to find Petra packing. She explained that she had been recalled to Germany to explain her son's defection. Jebsen tried to persuade her not to go, telling her he was on friendly terms with Lord Rothschild, who had asked him to come to England, a hint that he could help arrange her defection. Petra insisted she was not afraid, and caught the next plane to Berlin, knowing that under the Nazi system of collective punishment, she was probably doomed. She was arrested at the airport and sent to Sachsenhausen concentration camp. Her husband, son, and two daughters were also interned in concentration camps. Vermeeren's defection made Jebsen's own position more vulnerable. His friendship with the family was well known, and he was sure to be tarred by association. Canaris, the old fox, was no longer on hand to protect him. The younger and more energetic Georg Hansen was appointed head of counterintelligence and set about merging the remnants of the Abwehr into a new unified intelligence service. He is not a Nazi, reported Jebsen, but he is determined to prevent Germany's defeat. There is no doubt that Hansen means to reform the Abwehr completely. This new intelligence service would bear little relation to the dozy, dishonest, and partly disloyal organization Jebsen had joined back in 1939. Many of his supporters had been swept away with the fall of Canaris, replaced by men not at all to Jebsen's liking. The new officers have no experience of intelligence work, but they are keener and more active than their predecessors, and will probably succeed in tightening up the organization. One of these new appointees in particular made Jebsen a little uneasy. Major Wilhelm Kurbat was one of the stiffest new brooms in German intelligence. A professional soldier from East Prussia, he had fought on the Eastern Front before transferring to the Abwehr in July 1943 as Hansen's deputy. Kubat was 28, wide awake, ruthlessly proficient, and the most intelligent man in the Abwehr, Jebsen reported. The young major swiftly concluded that German intelligence was composed of elderly men with little or no idea of military organization. The Lisbon office in particular was discharging its functions most unsatisfactorily. Kubat paid a visit to Portugal and was shocked at the general immorality. Half the staff appeared to be sleeping with the other half. At least two of the secretaries were passing information to Jebsen. Von Karsthoff might insist that Jebsen was an extremely able man, but Kubat smelled something rather fishy. On returning to Berlin, he drew up a damning report recommending that von Karsthoff be removed and replaced, and the sleeping secretaries fired. "This brothel must be shut," Kubat declared.